The Peter Schiff Show. Today's podcast is sponsored by Indeed. Indeed knows hiring needs to be cost-effective when you're running your own business. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Peter. Terms and conditions apply. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views from multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the right insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. That's yahoofinance.com. I've been using Yahoo Finance since Yahoo began. I was searching on Yahoo before Google existed, and in fact, my personal email address is still a Yahoo address. But Yahoo remains my go-to site. When I need information about especially U.S.-listed companies, I always go to Yahoo Finance to look that information up. Plus, I also enjoy reading their articles and watching some of their video interviews. I even enjoy participating in their video interviews because Yahoo Finance has been interviewing me almost as long as there's been a Yahoo Finance. So take it from me, Yahoo Finance should be in every investor's toolkit. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. We all have our own unique challenges when it comes to work, health, family, and relationships. I've got a lot on my plate, and knowing how to recharge is crucial to my mental health. How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. At times, therapy has helped me and my loved ones in many ways, like learning positive coping skills, setting boundaries, and empowering us to become the best versions of ourselves. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major traumas. With the right guide, you can discover effective strategies to minimize distractions and truly connect with your needs, setting the stage for a more balanced life. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched up with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/gold today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/gold. Welcome, everybody, to a live Sunday night podcast. You know, I was doing these Sunday night podcasts a few months back, and then NFL football season started, and I thought people might be watching the games, including myself. I wanted to watch the game, so I stopped doing these Sunday night podcasts, but you know, football season is over, so the Sunday night podcasts are back. And in fact, today, everybody in the 50 states, or most people, moved the clocks forward by an hour. Because I remember when I was doing the podcast before, in order to do them at 8 o'clock Eastern, I had to start at 9 o'clock Puerto Rico time. But we don't observe daylight savings, so you guys caught up to me on the East Coast, so I'm actually doing the podcast 9 o'clock my time, but it's now 9 o'clock Eastern time, which might be a better time because that's 6 o'clock on the West Coast, and it's the same time they do the State of the Union address, which I will talk about Hate of the Union address towards the end of this podcast. But I figure if it's a good time for the State of the Union, it's probably a good time to maximize the viewership for the Peter Schiff Show podcast. So, first thing I want to talk about, gold prices continued to rise on Thursday and Friday. In fact, we almost got above 2,200 on Friday. Gold got to 2,195. I think it was up about $35 or so at that point. It backed off by the close. Gold closed up just under $20, just below 2,180. That was a record high close on a daily basis. It was a record high close on a weekly basis, and intraday, of course, it was a record high. Gold prices are rising again as I'm speaking. They're up $3-4. In fact, just before I started the podcast, I think we were up about $6 at $21.85. But you wouldn't know that gold hit a record high if you were watching the mainstream financial media, because they really didn't mention it. What they did talk about nonstop was Bitcoin, which also hit a new record high. In fact, we traded above 70,000 for the first time, although not we. I mean, I wasn't trading it, but somebody traded it, and Bitcoin got above 70,000, and that really stole all the headlines. But just because gold and Bitcoin made new record highs on the same day doesn't mean they made new record highs for the same reason, because they did not. And you have two diametrically opposed buyers. Gold was driven to new record highs by foreign central bank buying, which continues. And it happened despite retail selling. The retail public, the mom and pop investor trading their own account, continues to be a seller of gold as gold continues to go up. They're also a seller of gold mining stocks. You know, a lot of gold stocks were down. The GDXJ, which is an index of junior mining stocks, was actually negative on the day. Even though gold was up almost $20 to a new record high, people decided that it was a good time to sell their gold stocks. On the other hand, they were buying up the Bitcoin ETFs. The buyers of Bitcoin are not central banks, but mom and pop investors. And for my money, that's the contrarian indicator. What the retail public is buying is generally what you want to sell. And what the retail public is selling is what you want to buy. The smart money is buying gold. The dumb money is selling gold and buying Bitcoin. Again, I said on my last podcast, it's not just that the central banks could read the writing on the wall. They wrote the writing that's on the wall. So they know what it says. And it says, we're getting out of dollars, and that means gold's going up. And the interesting thing about Friday's gold market rally is that it happened against the backdrop of another much stronger than expected jobs report. And again, I put stronger in quotation because it actually was a very weak report. But the way the media reports it, and of course the way the Biden administration touts it, it was a strong report. But normally when we get one of these fake strong reports that beats on the headline job number, gold immediately sells off. But today, even though we got a strong report, gold rallied in the face of it. And that means that gold is done going down. It's just going up. Yes, it could go down slightly, but as I mentioned, we're off the floor. 2,000 was the support, and we may never see sub-$2,000 gold again. And the fact that we reacted the way we did to the non-farm payroll report is more proof that I'm right. And that when I did the podcast, the special podcast on gold, the only time it went below 2,000 all year, it only had two trading days in 2024 where it was below 2,000. And I said at the time that that was the final shakeout, and it looks like it was the final shakeout. But let me get to the jobs number that the media falsely claimed was a strong number. And the reason it's strong is that they always relate the number of jobs created to the number of jobs that were forecast to be created. So the consensus opinion was for 190,000 jobs. And again, as is always the case, the numbers we got from ADP on Wednesday, and I mentioned those on my last podcast, were actually below estimates. And that is the pattern. The private sector is a miss, but then the government numbers, which should be a lot more suspect, are a beat. And the February number was no exception to this rule. Even though the consensus forecast was 190,000 jobs, the government reported the creation of 275,000 jobs, a big beat.
In fact, not only was it a beat, but it exceeded the most optimistic estimate, because the range of forecasts went from a low of 95,000 to a high of 260. So 275 was above the upper estimate. So that was the headline. And gold rallied anyway. The dollar actually sold off. It wasn't a big decline, but it dropped on the day. And in fact, it was a very weak week. The dollar closed at like a two-month low as gold closed at a record high. Again, those things are not unrelated. They are moving in those directions for a reason. But once again, beneath the surface, and of course, the mainstream media never looks beneath the surface. It's always skin deep when it comes to these job numbers. But when you look beneath the surface, this was another weak report. First of all, one of the numbers that they did report was weak on its face, and that was the unemployment number. That rose to 3.9%. Now, that's still a low number, but it's the highest number in 2 years. And I know one of the things that the Biden administration likes to tout is that inflation and the unemployment rate are below 4%. Well, they're not going to be below 4% for long. I think by the time the voters go to the polls in November, we will be way above 4% in the unemployment rate and above 4% in the inflation rate. In fact, we may be above 4% in the March number that we get next month. But first of all, too, on that 275,000, that number is highly likely to be revised much lower next month, which is exactly what happened to the January number, which was reported last month at 353,000 jobs. That was revised down to 229,000. About 120,000 jobs were erased. In fact, I think this is the biggest one-month revision ever. I mean, that may not be the case, but certainly in a long time, that was a huge downward revision. And so given that, and given the tendency to revise down just about every number that we've had, why does anybody even care what the original number is? Why celebrate a beat that could be revised to a miss next month? But worse than the total number was looking at the type of jobs that were created. Again, the jobs were dominated by healthcare and education. 85,000 jobs there. And 52,000 jobs in government. Now, the problem is, too, a lot of the healthcare and education jobs, those are government jobs, too, right? They just fall under a different category. And even the healthcare jobs that are not government, where's the money coming from to pay for all this healthcare? A lot of that money is coming from government spending. So these are all related to government spending and the deficit, and they're not goods producing. But if you take healthcare, education, and government, that's 71% of the jobs. We don't need more government jobs. In fact, we have too many government jobs. We need to eliminate government jobs. We can't afford them because we don't have the money to pay for them. We need productive jobs. But look at what happened with manufacturing. I mean, this is where you really see the weakness. So the original report from last month was that 33,000 manufacturing jobs were created, or 23,000 rather, manufacturing jobs were created in January. That was revised down to just 8,000 jobs. Now, the consensus for February was for 10,000 more manufacturing jobs to be added. Well, not only did we not add 10,000 manufacturing jobs, we actually lost 4,000 jobs for the month. So 4,000 jobs disappeared. These are the productive jobs. I mean, Joe Biden keeps bragging about all the manufacturing jobs. We're not creating manufacturing jobs. Manufacturing is clearly in a recession. And all the other economic data that came out this week, in addition to losing 4,000 manufacturing jobs, supports the fact that manufacturing is in a recession. So you don't have a strong economy when manufacturing is this weak. But think about it this way. When you look at the number of manufacturing jobs they told us were created last month and the number that they were expected to create this month. And what actually came out, the markets thought we had 33,000 manufacturing jobs, 10,000 this month and 23,000 last month. Now we're being told that in total for the 2 months, we only have 4,000 manufacturing jobs. So 88% of the manufacturing jobs that the markets thought was and expected to have been created were eliminated. And of course, who knows how many of the jobs that we got for February. If they told us that we lost 4,000 jobs, maybe next month we'll find out we lost a lot more than that, which would eliminate 100% of the manufacturing jobs that they told us were created. The participation rate remained weak at 62.5%. Average hourly earnings, which I guess maybe is good news for some people, but not for the workers. They were looking for an increase of 0.3. We only got 0.1. And they revised the prior month from 0.6 to 0.5. So, you know, people are not working, earning as much. But their average hourly work week went up a bit because, you know, we have more people working more part-time jobs. But again, also, the household survey showed a net loss of jobs, as it always does. So the jobs that were created, these were all part-time jobs, and all of them went to immigrants. Native-born Americans continue to lose jobs, full-time jobs. We haven't created any jobs for Native-born Americans. So all the jobs that we're creating over the last year or so, maybe more, maybe two, are going to foreign-born workers. Now, some of them are here legally on work visas, but a lot of these workers are here illegally. And it makes sense. We have all these illegals coming across the border, and we have all these jobs. Well, because a lot of them are working. That's why we have so many jobs, is because we have so many illegals crossing the border that are getting jobs. Now, of course, that's better than them not working at all, right? I'd rather have somebody come here and work than be on welfare. But these things are going hand in hand, right? We have so many people coming through our non-existent borders. It makes sense that they're taking these jobs. But that's also why Biden is so unpopular, because in theory, at least, the illegals can't vote. And they're not supposed to be in the polls of likely voters. So one of the reasons that the voters are so unhappy with the Biden economy is because they're not the ones that got jobs, or the only jobs they have are the two or three part-time jobs they wish they didn't have. And the new jobs, the low-paying jobs that are being created for these immigrants who are not supposedly being captured by the polls. Anyway, we got a quick commercial break. We'll be right back. I got a lot more to talk about, so don't go anywhere.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messages so you can contact with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agreed Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join the 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. What I love most about Indeed is how simple it makes the hiring process and allows you to do all your hiring in one place. Candidates you invite to apply are three times more likely to actually apply for your job than the candidates who see it in search alone, according to US Indeed data. Indeed gets you one step closer to the hire by immediately matching you with quality candidates. And now, listeners of my show can get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Peter. Just go to Indeed.com/Peter right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Peter. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, then you need Indeed.
Before I continue with the stuff I want to talk about, I want to make a little announcement. I meant to make it on the last podcast and I forgot.
So I want to make sure I remember by doing it now. But so the reporter, Nick McKenzie, journalist in quotes, right, who I sued for defamation and I won my lawsuit, him and his partner at The Age, Charlotte Grieve, who I also sued, she was one of the respondents who lost my defamation lawsuit. And they didn't just lose the suit. They lost 7 consecutive judgments in a row, which is probably a record in the Australian federal court system. And they lost because they had no defense, and they kept lying that they had a defense, and the judge kept throwing out their defenses because they had nothing there, and he kept giving them another opportunity to come up with a defense, and they kept failing because they had nothing. But not only did they lose a defamation lawsuit, but discovery proved that they lied and committed fraud, and so these are very bad people, Nick McKenzie and Charlotte Grieve. They're liars, they're frauds. I've called them that. I've put that out on Twitter. Of course, they can't sue me for defamation. I've encouraged them to sue me, but they can't sue me because I have the facts to prove that they are liars and frauds. So it's not defamation if it's true. See, they tried to claim that when they accused me of all these crimes, that it was true, but they didn't have any evidence. That's why they lost, and that's why I won. But I have plenty of evidence, which is why they can't sue me, because they would lose. But anyway, the reason I'm bringing it up is because Nick McKenzie was just nominated for Journalist of the Year for 2023, the same year that he lost a defamation lawsuit. Now, it's very rare that a journalist is sued for defamation and loses. I mean, it's a high bar. I mean, these guys can get away with a lot of stuff. But for somebody to sue somebody for defamation and they lose, that's pretty bad. How do you get Journalist of the Year for the year that you lost a defamation lawsuit? But that's what the people who nominated him, this is the Melbourne Press Club, and it's the 29th annual Quill Awards. And, you know, I reached out to the people who nominated McKenzie, and I said, hey, how are you nominating a guy for Journalist of the Year when he lost a defamation lawsuit for the same year? I mean, there's got to be other journalists that weren't sued for defamation who didn't lose that you can nominate. You know, and not only did he lose, but I said, hey, I got the proof that the guy's a liar and a fraud. So why do you want to give an award for Journalist of the Year to a journalist who lies and commits fraud? I mean, he should get an award for the worst Journalist of the Year. I mean, if they had a nomination for the worst Journalist of the Year, not only would Nick McKenzie get nominated, he would win, right? But no, they want to give him the award for best journalist. So I sent this, I reached out to these guys. They won't respond to me. In addition, his partner in crime, Charlotte Grieve, who already won Best Young Journalist of the Year for the 60 Minutes broadcast that was ruled defamatory and ordered off the internet, she won an award for excellence in journalism for that trash piece of tabloid junk that was removed from the internet. And City Australia refuses to ask for their award back, which clearly she didn't deserve. But now she's nominated, I think, twice for investigative journalism. Well, her investigations are a lie. She doesn't report what her investigations uncover. What discovery in my lawsuit proved is that she fabricates evidence. She ignores her own evidence. She starts out with a preconceived conclusion, and then she does an investigation and ignores everything the investigation finds and basically misrepresents what she did find to justify her preconceived conclusion, even if her own investigation proves that she's wrong, which means the investigation is a farce. It's a pretense to try to pretend that she's an investigative journalist when she doesn't really investigate anything, she just makes it up. So the reason I am bringing this up on this podcast is the award ceremony is on March 15th. Now, I'm not going to be down there. It's in Melbourne, Australia. It's at the Crown Palladium in South Bank in Melbourne. Now, I'm mentioning it because I know I got some fans of this podcast that live down there, right, down under in Melbourne. I'd like people to go to this thing and protest. Take, you know, make a picket sign, you know, about Nick McKenzie and Charlotte Grieve. Maybe take a picture of me. But, you know, you lost the defamation lawsuit, lawyer fraud, just some type of protest out front. So when these reporters show up to potentially win these rewards, I'd like them to see the protest.
you know, and maybe get your friends to come. It could be fun. You know, if you don't live in Melbourne, I mean, maybe if you live in, you know, in Sydney or something, you can fly down for the weekend, you know, have a little trip, maybe see some other fans of the Peter Schiff Show podcast, and then put these protests, you know, up on the internet. You guys do anything, I can share it, you know, on my Twitter, on my or X, on my Instagram, Facebook, or something like that. I'd appreciate a little help, you know, just shining a light on these guys, because the mainstream media is covering for these guys. Even our media in the United States, even the New York Times, everybody, Wikipedia, nobody will let the truth come out that these two highly acclaimed reporters are frauds and liars, and you can't believe anything that they write or anything that they say, and my case proves it. I have all the evidence that proves it, and no one seems to care. So maybe some of the Australian public can go down there and protest these award ceremonies and these so-called journalists. And I think it'll be fun. But anyway, so it's at the Crown Palladium in South Bank, Melbourne. The doors open at 6:30. Try to get there a little earlier. Get there at 6. The award ceremony starts at 7 o'clock. It's on the 15th of March, which happens to be my mother's birthday. She's going to turn, what, I think 83 on March 15th. But anyway, so let me get back to the podcast. So I was talking about the jobs numbers. So basically, again, another weak number when you look beneath the surface. Lost jobs. The media reports it as a strong number. But the most significant thing is the markets don't care anymore. The dollar went down. Gold went up. So that's it. Gold's going up. The dollar's going down. All that's going to happen is those trends are going to accelerate. The dollar is going to start falling faster, and gold's going to start rising faster, right? I don't see any resistance in that gold chart. I mean, clearly there's no resistance. It's an all-time record high. So there's really nothing to stop the market from going up. And the fact that the public is not on board for the ride, even better, because there's no reason for a correction. There's no need to shake anybody out because nobody's in. It's just these central banks, and they're going to keep buying. They have a lot of gold that they need to buy, and they know exactly why they're buying it, and they got a war chest. And so they're going to keep putting this money to work regardless. And eventually, you know, investors are going to try to buy too. And then where's the gold going to come from? I mean, I don't know, because it's not getting mined. I mean, there's some, but not nearly enough to satisfy the demand. Now, let me talk a little bit more first, before I get to Powell, I want to talk about a few other economic data points that came out in addition to the job number that I thought were relevant. One was the consumer credit number. Again, what is inflation? It's an expansion of money and credit. So if the Fed were fighting inflation, you would expect a contraction in credit, but that's not happening. Consumer credit, which was supposed to rise by $9.3 billion for the month of January, rose by $19.5 billion. Again, consumer credit is expanding. Consumers are borrowing and spending more money. What does that tell you? Credit is too easy. Monetary policy is accommodative. It's not restrictive. And I'm going to get to Powell, but one of the things Powell said in his testimony, because again, I talked about his testimony before the House. On Thursday, he spoke before the Senate, but he told both bodies that monetary policy is well into restrictive territory, well into. It's not restrictive at all. It's still accommodative. The Fed is accommodating consumer credit. The Fed is accommodating government credit. The Fed is accommodating the deficits. It's accommodating the markets. It's not restricting anything. It's all a bunch of BS. And these consumer credit numbers show that. The Challenger job cut numbers that came out on Thursday, another huge number, even bigger than the huge number that we got in January. January, 82,307 announced layoffs. And in February, 84,638. These are big numbers, much bigger than the numbers we were getting before. And these layoffs, These are real jobs, right? These are big companies with full-time workers getting laid off, right? So the jobs we're creating are minimum wage or, you know, close to it, part-time service sector jobs or jobs in the government, healthcare, leisure, and hospitality. That was the other big segment, which I think I mentioned leisure and hospitality were 58,000 jobs. But so those are the low-paying jobs that are being added. It's the good jobs, high-paying jobs with benefits going to native-born Americans. These are the ones that are being lost. So again, more data on weakness in the jobs market. Also, the trade deficit, goods and services, came out worse than expected, way worse, especially when you consider the upward revisions to the prior month. So last month, they told us the trade deficit was $62.2 billion. This month, they said, nope, it was $64.2 billion. We were off by $2 billion. Now, the January number was supposed to be $63.7 billion. Instead, it was $67.4 billion. That's 5% more than they thought, but it's even bigger than the revised numbers because we actually, I mean, for what they originally thought, because we went from 62.2 to 67.4. So based on what they thought it was going to be, it was last year to what it, last month, to what it actually was this month, it's an even bigger expansion of the trade deficit. The only reason it's smaller is because we revised the prior month up. But both of these numbers are going to detract from GDP because by definition, you subtract the trade deficit from GDP. But again, this shows you that we have more upward pressure on prices because we're producing less stuff. Again, manufacturing is in a recession, but consumers are spending and buying stuff. So where are we getting all this stuff? If we're not producing it, we are importing it. So the trade deficits are going up because we're not producing what we're consuming. But that also means that there's going to be more downward pressure on the dollar because we're going to have bigger trade deficits. All this means more inflation, a weaker dollar, higher prices. So all this talk about how inflation is, you know, over and the Fed is victorious in its inflation battle is all a bunch of talk. As I said, the inflation war is over and inflation won and the Fed lost. Anyway, let me get to some of the points that Powell made in the Thursday talk, which again, I think was dovish. I think even though Powell, you know, yeah, you know, we're going to get rid of inflation, you know, we're going to make sure there's no inflation. If you actually look at what he said, it's pretty dovish. I mean, first of all, Powell said that we don't need any better data on inflation, that the data we've got is good enough. It just can't get any worse. So what the Fed wants is the data we've got to continue. But the data we've got is already above 2%. I mean, we're in the low threes, which means we're probably at six. But the data doesn't justify a rate cut. In fact, the data already proves, and I'm talking about all the data taken in whole, not just the inflation numbers, but all the data on spending and debt and all that stuff supports additional rate hikes, but we're not getting them because the Fed is afraid to hike because of how broke we are. So they made up an excuse to stop. But to say that we don't need any improvement in the data, that the data we've got now is good enough, it just needs to continue and not get any worse, right? That's very dovish to me. And of course, it's not going to continue because it will get worse. But the Fed is probably going to ignore that because they're still saying that we got a strong labor market, that we got a strong economy, which we don't. And so what I do expect is eventually we probably will get these rate cuts or some rate cuts between now and the election. But it's not going to be because inflation comes down. It's going to be because unemployment goes up. That's what's going to be the catalyst, a weakening economy, even though we get a strengthening in the inflation rate. But another thing that Powell said that I thought was particularly dovish, in the past, he was saying that, you know, we need more data to be confident that we've won, right? That inflation is going to finish the journey down to 2%, that it's going to coast down there, right? And so then we can, you know, start preemptively cutting rates because we know we've won, right? Even though inflation is not at 2%, we can be confident that it's going to go there on its own because Powell acknowledges that monetary policy works with a lag. And so we're not going to wait for 2% to cut. We're going to start cutting in anticipation of 2%. Well, what he said this time to the Senate was he said we need more data to be confident, but then he said we're almost there. I forget the exact word, but it's like, look, we're close. We've almost got enough data to be confident, which to me means he's setting it up for, okay, whether it's next meeting or the meeting after that, we're there, right? Regardless of what the data is, because none of the data that we have should give him any confidence of anything. So the fact that he's saying we've almost got enough data to be completely convinced that we're going to 2% means it's all BS. He's making it up, but he's under intense political pressure from Biden, and he keeps sinking in the polls, even though, you know, he managed to get through his State of the Union address, you know, without collapsing or, you know, any major gaffes, which I guess that was the bar, right? As long as he could get out of the address, you know, he could read from his teleprompter and finish the speech. That was basically the bar, right? Didn't even matter what he said. All he had to do was finish it without looking like, you know, he had a mental problem. But it was a horrible speech, and I'll get to that, you know, a little bit later. But let me finish on this. But as Powell's popularity goes down, that just puts, I mean, not Powell, as Biden's popularity goes down, that puts more pressure on Powell and the Fed to do something to prop up the economy, and all they've got is rate cuts and, you know, a return to QE, which may actually happen first. You know, when we could go back to quantitative easing, and it won't be official. They don't have to officially said we're doing it. They just start doing it right behind the scenes because the bank problem gets worse because the maturity of this, you know, bailout that started a month ago expires next week, and this could be a huge problem for the banks. But one of the most ridiculous, or maybe the most ridiculous thing that Powell said on Thursday, there was a senator, I forget who asked the question. I think it was a female senator, but I forget who it was. But the senator said, you know, isn't this a problem that the Federal Reserve is loaning all this money to the U.S. government and is financing these large Biden deficits? Now, instead of, you know, trying to argue that it wasn't a problem, Powell said it wasn't even happening. Powell's response was that that's not even true. Powell said that the Federal Reserve is not loaning money to the U.S. government, and the Federal Reserve is not helping to finance the deficits. Now, that's just a bold-faced lie. I mean, how can he even say something like that? Unless Powell doesn't believe that buying treasuries is the same thing as loaning the U.S. government money, because it is. When you buy U.S. treasuries, you are loaning the U.S. government money. I mean, that's exactly what you're doing. So the fact that the Fed has a $7.5 trillion balance sheet, and at the same time, Powell says we're not loaning money to the U.S. government. Of course you are. The Fed has loaned the U.S. government $7.5 trillion. The U.S. government owes the Fed $7.5 trillion. I mean, if that's not a loan, what the hell is it? And of course, why is the Fed loaning the government all this money? Because the way you loan the government money is you buy their bonds. The government goes out and sells bonds. That's how it borrows money. And it borrows it from the people who buy those bonds. And if the Fed is buying the bonds, then the government, by definition, is borrowing money from the Fed. Yet Powell said the Fed is not loaning any money to the U.S. government. I mean, he can't be that dumb, right? So he's clearly just lying. But then to say he's not financing the budget deficit, of course he's financing. Why does the government have to sell bonds? Well, one of the main reasons is because we're running a deficit. And whoever is buying those bonds is financing that deficit. Now, true, the Fed is no longer buying treasuries. So the Fed is not currently financing the deficits, but it was financing the deficits in the past. And of course, the Fed is still rolling over a lot of maturing debt. It's not asking for its money back. So to the extent that the Fed is rolling over any debt, that would count as financing deficits and loaning money to the U.S. government, because they're not asking for their money back when their loans mature. But it was right to ask the question. It was completely wrong, not only from Powell to duck the question, but he lied about the question. And again, you know, the thing that always burns me up the most about these press conferences, which is really, you know, they're really not hearings. They're, you know, they're opportunities for the Democrats and the Republicans to try to score points with their constituents by claiming credit for whatever's good and blaming the other side for whatever's bad. But I don't like the fact that Powell refuses to answer any questions on the grounds that he can't comment on something political, which is a complete, you know, distortion of the concept of an independent Fed. An independent Fed is not supposed to refrain from criticizing the government. That's not why it's independent. It's independent precisely so it can criticize the government. And it's not, and that is the problem. Powell should be telling Congress what it's doing wrong and what it needs to do, which is cut spending, stop spending money. He can't say, well, that's a political decision. In fact, what Powell said is he said, we just take whatever fiscal policy comes our way. Like, we don't care what it is. We just take what we get. No, you don't take what you get. That's not what Paul Volcker did. Paul Volcker kept telling Congress, cut spending. Spending's the problem. You're creating inflation. You're putting me in a bind. Or you need to cut government spending. The debts are too high. We need an independent central bank to say these things to the Congress. See, the independence is supposed to go one way. Congress is not supposed to criticize the Fed. But that doesn't mean the Fed is not supposed to criticize Congress, because Powell doesn't get elected, right? Powell is there to criticize Congress. So if Congress is passing bad laws to get votes, it's up to Powell to say, hey, stop doing that. You're doing bad stuff. And when they ask him, well, do you think we should raise the minimum wage? He's not supposed to say, well, that's a political decision. I've got no opinion on that. He should be saying, of course not. We're trying to fight inflation. That's going to add to the problem. Don't do it, right? It's obvious. But it's all, you know, a coward's way out, because he doesn't want to criticize what the government is doing, which means it's going to continue. And it also means that Powell is not serious about fighting inflation. Because if he says, I don't care how big the deficits are, we just take them as they come, well, anything he says about his commitment to fighting inflation, you can take with a grain of salt. It's all BS. There is no inflation fight. The Fed is all bark and no bite. And that's the reason that gold's at a record high. And that's the reason that it's going to keep going up, and it's going to make new all-time record highs. And just imagine what's going to happen when the public wakes up, when the public starts buying, when institutions start buying, right? Because the central banks are going to keep buying. It's just that who are they going to buy from when the fools who have been selling their gold to buy Bitcoin ETFs run out of gold? And then, of course, eventually the Bitcoin ETFs are going to crash, because Bitcoin crashes, and then all that Bitcoin demand is gone, and then all that's left is gold. Anyway, I want to talk about, before I go to the State of the Union, one report that was really bothering me, that they kept talking, because it was National Women's Day or something like that on Friday. So I guess CNBC felt like they had to talk a lot about National Women's Day. And one of the problems, you know, that they identified was that not enough women are working. And so they looked at the percentage of women in the working, which is at a record high in America, right? We got more women working now than ever, right? But they said it's not enough because, you know, it's less than women in other countries, right? Women in other countries, although they weren't looking at Japan, but they're probably looking at a lot of European countries. And they said, hey, you know, this is a problem. We don't have enough women working. And look, this is, you know, like, this is bad for women. They need to get out there and work. And they talked about all the economic output that we're missing out on because we don't have enough of our women in the workforce. And I'm like, women working is not a sign of economic success. At one point, it was women not working that was a measure of your success. It was that women didn't have to work. You know, once upon a time, everybody worked, even the kids worked, right? But capitalism made it so kids didn't have to work anymore. They could go to school. Women didn't have to work. They could stay home. Their husband had a job. That's it. It took one guy, and he had a job, and that was it. It didn't even matter what the job was. Blue-collar job. If you were a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, you had a job. Your wife didn't have to work, right? I mean, back in the 1950s, or, you know, if your wife had a job, you'd be embarrassed to admit that your wife had a job. What's wrong? You can't support your wife? I mean, a guy would take a second job before his wife had a job. Now, not that what women didn't work, right? They still did housework. I'm not undervaluing it. But, you know, there was something wrong with you if you couldn't support your family, not just your wife, right, but your kids, right? And it was easy to do. Anybody could support a family. Now, obviously, you know, if you were wealthy or if you were a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, you could support your wife and your family, you know, more lavishly. You could have a bigger house. You could have nicer cars. You could take fancier vacations. But if you were a bus driver, a truck driver, policeman, fireman, your wife didn't have to work. You could support her, right? And so now they're talking about the fact that we need more women working because not enough women are in the workforce. The reason that so many women are working is because their husbands can't afford to support them. It all started in the 1970s. And it didn't start because of women's liberation. Women were liberated when they didn't have to work. The minute they were forced to work, they lost all that liberty, right? I mean, yeah, any woman could choose to work if she wants to. The problem is now women can't choose not to work. They're forced to work. I mean, sometimes, you know, you go to a market and you'll see a woman behind a cash register who's pregnant. I mean, obviously, maybe she's 7 months pregnant. You think she wants that job? Of course not. She's there because she has to. She's there because if she didn't have that job, they couldn't pay the rent. They couldn't buy groceries. So, you know, ironically, CNBC is probably going to get their wish. More women are going to be working, not because they want to, because they have to, because the standard of living is going down, right? Not up. If, you know, if we had a rising standard of living, more women would have the choice, right? If you look at the women who don't work, they're generally the women who are married to very wealthy men, high-earning men, right? So, because they don't have to, right? The more money the husband earns, the less likely it is that the wife works. That tells you something, right? It tells you that women are working by necessity, not by choice. Now, that's not always the case. Yeah, you know, there are career women out there that really enjoy their jobs, and there are some situations where the women or the wife out-earns the husband. And there are circumstances where you have a woman who's making a lot of money and her husband stays at home and raises the kids, right? You know, that happens. I mean, it's the exception, not the rule, but it's there, right? So the fact that all these women are working, that is the problem. It is not the solution to the problem. It is the problem. And it wouldn't be a problem if we really had a strong, vibrant economy, but we don't. We've been having a declining standard of living, and the government keeps trying to tell us that everything is getting better because they point to the GDP, which is all about inflation or other statistics, and they ignore the erosion of the buying power of an American paycheck. Anyway, let me wrap up today's podcast by talking about the misstate of the union by Biden. And of course, the most significant part of the state of the union is what he didn't discuss. You know, not what he did discuss. I mean, first of all, he leads off the state of the union talking about Ukraine and how important it is that we keep supporting the war effort in the Ukraine. I mean, we got a lot of important stuff that we got to worry about here, not the Ukraine. In fact, financing that war is part of the problems that we have, right? I mean, the fact that the State of the Union address was about the state of the Ukraine and, you know, anti-Putin, and we got to stop Putin, as if, like, if we let him have Ukraine, the next thing you know, he's going to be, you know, in the United States. I mean, this is all a bunch of nonsense. We have real problems that Biden should be discussing, not what's going on, you know, on the other side of the world in a war that basically the only reason the war is even going on is because of us. And it doesn't matter at all. The outcome is irrelevant to what's going to happen in the United States. Doesn't really matter from that respect. Sure, it's relative to the Ukrainians. Maybe it's relative to the Russians. But it's immaterial to Americans, right? Because we don't really have a dog in this fight. It doesn't matter, right? They are overselling this conflict as if this is significant, at least as if Putin is Adolf Hitler. And if we don't stop him now, we're going to have World War III. The reality is we could inadvertently start World War III for no reason whatsoever, right? But I digress there. So he talks about what's going on in Ukraine. Doesn't really talk about the fiscal time bomb, the exploding national debt, the fact that interest costs now exceed the defense budget. I mean, this is a fiscal time bomb. I mean, we are very close to a major economic crisis. Biden needs to talk about what he's going to do to defuse this bomb. No, I'm not going to cut Social Security. I'm not going to cut Medicare. If anybody tries to cut anything, I am going to stop them. That's what he talked about. Now, he did kind of claim credit for reducing the deficit. How? The debt's going crazy. How do you claim credit for reducing something that went way up while you were president? Oh, well, could it have gone up more had we, you know, stayed on the trajectory of COVID? Yes, but COVID's over. You know, when he looks at COVID, he wants to, you know, cherry pick the data. So he's going to say, I cut the deficit only because it was much bigger when the economy was shut down. I mean, of course it was going to go down. It couldn't have stayed at that level. But if you look at the deficits post-COVID versus where they were pre-COVID, they're way up. So Biden has massively increased the pre-COVID deficits. But look at how he counts jobs. He wants to say that he's created all these jobs. He didn't create anything. These jobs were the jobs that were put on hold. At the same time, Biden says Trump lost all these jobs. Like, more jobs were lost by Trump than any other president. Those are the same jobs that he claims he created. They weren't lost. They were put on hold. And then when he comes into office, they're taken off hold. But he's distorting all this COVID stuff to try to make him look good. So he claims creating jobs that he didn't create, and he claims he cut deficits that he didn't cut, right? So everything is being hidden behind this facade of COVID. But if you look at what Biden proposed, all he proposed was more government spending. When government spending is the problem, right? What did he propose for housing? Credits, tax credits for people to go out and buy a home. Well, where's the government going to get that money? It's going to have to borrow it, which means more inflation. And what are people going to do with the tax credits? Well, that just means they can bid up prices more. They get government money to buy a house, so housing prices go up, right? That's all it does. It doesn't help the people who are buying the houses. It helps the people who are selling the houses get a higher price, right? But it's all inflationary. He also promised, you know, more money for students. You know, one of the things he said is he wants to give all teachers a raise, which that's great. Everybody applauds when you say you want to give teachers a raise. How's he going to give teachers a raise? I mean, they're not employed by the federal government, right? But if teachers get a raise, what does that mean? Well, that means the community has to pay the teachers more money. So all the people clapping because the teachers are going to get a raise, well, they're going to have a pay cut. Because the teachers make money that everybody else has to pay. If you're talking, he mentioned public school teachers. The taxpayers pay their salary. So yeah, you want to give the teachers a raise, everybody else has to get a pay cut in order to finance that raise. But all of it was government, you know, spending more money on various things when what we need is cuts. He didn't talk about anything he wants to cut. All he wants to do is spend more money when inflation is the problem. You know, and of course, you know, they want to talk about shrinkflation again. There is no such thing as shrinkflation. I mean, this is all BS, shrinkflation. I mean, shrinkflation helps mask inflation, right? Biden catches a break. And this has been going on for decades. This isn't new. This happened under other presidents. And it's one of the reasons that the CPI is a bunch of BS, because it doesn't properly account for the degradation of quantity and quality. Companies have constantly been substituting lower quality ingredients and reduced quantity to avoid raising price. But it's still a price hike. It's just a price hike fed to the consumer in a different way, because the businesses are trying not to turn off their customers. So rather than hit them on the head with the fact that they've just raised their prices, they try to do it more subtly. But why are they raising prices in the first place? Whether they raise prices by shrinking the quantity or just increasing the price, it's inflation that is causing them to do it. So this phenomena of shrinkflation is a consequence of inflation. That's just one way that businesses respond to inflation, is by reducing quantity. Now, the Biden administration is somehow acting like this is a brand new thing, that all these greedy companies are just pulling a fast one and trying to screw the public. And this shrinkflation is what's causing the inflation, when he's got the cart before the horse. It's the government's inflation that is causing the shrinkflation, right? And so he's just trying to, again, blame somebody else for a government-created problem. The only thing that he did recommend, which you could consider fiscal, is higher taxes on the billionaires. That's it. He wants to tax the billionaires with a minimum tax of 25% on what, I don't know, because they're already paying a tax on their income. And I guess I don't know how you even have the minimum tax. I guess maybe if some of the rich people have muni bonds, I guess they won't be able to have that tax-free income. But somehow he wants like a 25% minimum tax to tax income that doesn't even exist, because the millionaires and billionaires already pay an income tax, and the top rate is like 38%. So they're paying that rate. Now, maybe I guess they could say, well, you can't use some of your deductions, and so they're effectively not even taxing income if you're not allowing certain deductions. And so I think all that stuff is unconstitutional, because the 16th Amendment allows for the taxation of income, and income means your revenue minus your expenses. And if they try to limit your expenses, they end up taxing something that's not really income. It ends up becoming a property tax disguised as an income tax, and it's unconstitutional because it's not apportioned. But even this attempt of extra money, and of course, yes, they want to raise the corporate tax rate as well. These tax hikes, even if they happened, would not produce any significant quantity of revenue to the government. And they may even backfire, which happens a lot when you raise the marginal tax rate, when you raise the corporate tax rate. Corporations and high-income earners often rearrange their affairs in such a way to avoid those extra taxes. And it ends up backfiring, because one of the ways they may avoid those extra taxes is they don't hire as many people. They're not as productive as they otherwise would have been. And so it's not just that they don't get the taxes from the billionaires and the corporations, but they don't get the taxes from the jobs that they don't create, or they lose the tax revenue from the jobs that they eliminate. And because the higher taxes could distort economic activity and lead to a less vibrant economy, there's less overall income being generated. And so they backfire. And so you end up with higher tax rates, but lower tax revenue. What we don't need are more taxes. We need less government. In fact, I'd like everybody to pay lower taxes. It's not just that we shouldn't raise taxes on the billionaires. The billionaires already pay more than their fair share, and the millionaires. Like, that's what Biden says. They're not paying their fair share. Yeah, they're not paying their fair share. They're paying more than their fair share. We need to cut taxes for the millionaires and the billionaires, but we need to cut taxes for everybody else. Everybody who's working, I think, in America is being overtaxed. But we can't cut anybody's taxes unless we massively reduce government spending. And if we don't reduce government spending, then everybody's taxes have to be raised, especially the people who Biden claims he doesn't want to tax, because it's the middle class who has to have a significant tax increase if we're not going to cut government spending, including entitlements. But we're not going to do that, and so everybody is going to be taxed by inflation. It's the inflation tax that's going to destroy the middle class and the poor. A lot of the rich will avoid that by owning the type of assets that you should own that will preserve their value in an inflationary period. Although a lot of people own the wrong assets, and that's what we're trying to do at Euro Pacific Asset Management and at Shift Gold, is to make sure that everybody owns the correct asset types that will best protect you from the inflation tax. Anyway, that's it for this Sunday. Stick around. You know, we got a lot more podcasts coming up following, next week. I'm sure there's going to have a lot of action in the markets. I'll be talking about that. And again, don't forget, give this thing a thumbs up. You like it. Leave me a comment. And that's it for now. Thanks, everybody, for listening.